Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
I'm here for the appellant, Roland Williams. This case is here on transfer from the Court of Appeals, Eastern District. The facts in this case are unambiguous, and they are not in dispute. The facts of this case began with a domestic dispute with Mr. Williams and his wife of 10 years, who were separated at the time of this incident. He went to their home to pick up some belongings. When he got there, he only had two bags of belongings. At this point, he became angry. He approached his wife, who was in the kitchen, began to argue. He pulled out a gun, put it to her head, threatened to shoot her. Her children, who were in another room, her sons, came in. He also threatened to shoot them. But then he demanded money. Once they gave him money, he left. No shots were fired. And he was convicted of one count of first-degree robbery, one count of armed criminal action, and one count of unlawful use of a weapon. Mr. Williams appealed his filed the 2915 post-conviction motion, where he raised an issue that his appellate attorney on direct appeal was ineffective because she failed to raise the issue that his unlawful use of a weapon, the evidence raised against his unlawful use of a weapon was insufficient because the weapon was never found. In reviewing the state's case, I found that all of their cases had something that showed either that the gun was functional, the gun had bullets, the bullets nearby, or there was some strong circumstantial evidence that the gun was readily capable of.
The elements of a crime would be defined by this statute, correct? Not necessarily what prosecuting attorneys decide to introduce as evidence, which oftentimes they try to overrule their case, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What do you think the statute requires in this case?
Well, I'll just read it. In this case, the statute requires... got it written down. I want to read it per se. Unlawful use of a weapon, 571.0030. A person commits the crime of unlawful use of a weapon if he or she knowingly, one, carries concealed upon or about his or her person a knife, firearm, or blackjack, or any other weapon readily capable of lethal use. Subsection 4, exhibits in the presence of one or more persons any weapon readily capable of lethal use in an angry or threatening manner. Here, we can see that Mr. Williams had a weapon and he exhibited in an angry and threatening manner. But what we have issue with is that the state proved that that the weapon was readily capable of lethal use. And before I go farther, I wanted to point out to the court a case that the state used. It was the Larkin case. It was State v. Larkin that I think the court should give no weight. In that case, the court found that under this statute, 564.610, it was unnecessary for the state to prove that the shotgun involved was loaded to make a prima facie case. And the court further found under that statute, it was unnecessary for the state to prove that the shotgun was capable of discharge. I believe this court should not give that statute any weight because in researching this statute, we found, one, that this statute was enacted in 1959. It was transferred to a statute 571.115 in 1978, and then the statute was repealed 30 years ago in 1981. And so I don't think the court should rely on this case at all, because it's not based on a statute that, and it took us a lot to find the statute. We had to go to the library of the Court of Appeals to find the statute. It's so old, it's not online or anything.
Can you address why his use of the weapon in a threatening manner is not circumstantial evidence that it's readily capable of lethal use?
In all the other cases that we looked at, that the statement, the fact that it was that was an issue of being threatening, but there was other evidence. There was evidence to show that the gun was functional, or in some cases the person fired the gun in the air, so you know, or they got it back to the police.
Why is that necessary, though?
Because you have to, the gun, according to the verdict director, it has to be readily capable of lethal use. While I understand it does not have to be loaded, but in all the cases where it was not loaded, there was ammunition nearby. Like in one case, the gun was unloaded in one pocket and the ammunition was in a pouch in another pocket, which means it was readily capable of being loaded.
And I understand what you're saying, but why isn't his use of it, his saying, I'm going to shoot you with this, his assertion that he can shoot you with it then, and then you can come back and say, but in fact, here's the gun, you know, it's not loaded, or you can come back and show it was a non-functional gun, but here where the gun was thrown away, why would it be fair to let defendants say, I threw away the gun, you can't prove it was functional, even though I threatened somebody with it?
I do think the state has the burden of proving each and every element of the verdict director, and one of the elements of the verdict director is that you have to prove that the gun or was readily available for lethal use, or at least have some strong circumstantial evidence that points to that.
What about the state's argument that in the first part of the statute that you read where it talks about or any other weapon capable of lethal use, what about the state's argument that if it's a firearm, a blackjack, or a knife, we all know those are readily capable of lethal use? There's certainly no word called, there's no nothing in the statute that says functional or operational. The modifying phrase readily capable of lethal use seems to apply to any other weapon.
Well, I believe that to be readily capable, as I said before, you have to at least have bullets. In this case,
well, excuse me. I guess my point is that firearm, knife, and blackjack, as I understand it, the state argues that we know those things are readily capable of lethal use, but there might be some other type of weapon. And then in those situations where there's some other type of weapon, for example, a coat hanger or something like that, that's when this extra burden would come on, or a rock or right. something like that, to prove that it was readily capable of lethal use.
And they say you can infer that from the definition in the possession part of the statute that says if you possess a firearm, blackjack, knife, or other weapon readily capable of lethal use, that it implies that those are automatically readily capable, and others you have to show are readily capable.
It's my understanding it readily shows that it's a deadly weapon, but there was no evidence in this case, in Mr. Williams' case, not to show, one, not only that it wasn't loaded, two, whether or not he had bullets somewhere nearby, he could have made it loaded. Three, there was no evidence to show that
the question
it was
is,
functional.
Does the statute make anybody show that? Why is that an element under the statute? Doesn't the statute assume that guns, knives, and blackjacks are readily capable of lethal use, so you don't have to put on any evidence as part of the state's case, though the defendant can put on evidence to show they weren't capable, they weren't functioning or loaded as a defense?
Well, that was not my understanding of that they didn't put up, because all the cases I looked at, the court at some point found by some strong circumstantial evidence, that's why these cases are fact sensitive, that there was circumstantial evidence that the case, that the gun was readily capable of lethal use. But since the statute is silent on that, I have to go with the facts of the case, and I didn't find any cases that said that, so I relied on. And the only case that, like I said, was this Larkin case that did say that that case is based on the statute that's been repealed for 31 years.
Was the language in the prior statute different than the language here?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, I have it with me. I mean, it talks about a lot of different weapons that we don't use today, but it doesn't talk at all about being readily capable for lethal use. Language is not in there at all. And the two statutes were transferred. The big difference between them was how much time he spent in prison. I think one of them was 2 years, the other one was five.
How do you distinguish the State versus Richardson case?
In Richardson, I think the weapon wasn't found in that one.
That's the case where they didn't find the gun.
Right. I think in Richardson, the difference is the court looked really strong at the facts of the case. In that case, this was between two strangers. Richardson started a fight. He threw down a bottle. He pulled out a knife. He's trying to stab the victim. When he can't stab the victim, he slaps him in the face. The victim picks up a maul handle. And at that point, Richardson runs a half a block to his house, picks up a shotgun, and comes back and says, it was a crowd of people out by that time. I'm going to shoot all of you, and I have enough in my hand to shoot all of you. I got out of that not only, he had a lethal weapon when he had the knife. He only ran when the guy had something to defend himself. I don't believe he'd run and get an unloaded weapon and come back. And then the other thing is he said he had something that made me think that not only did he have that gun, but he also had shotgun shells. If he's trying to kill a crowd of people, that's very different from the facts in this case. I have any more questions?
Thank you very much. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. The real issue in this case is the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And to prevail on that claim, the appellant would be required to establish that Timothy Fornaris, the appellate counsel on direct appeal, failed to raise a claim of error that was so obvious that a competent and effective lawyer would have recognized that issue and asserted it on appeal. In this particular case, there was sufficient evidence at trial of unlawful use of a weapon, so a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence would not have been a claim of error so obvious that...
Was there any evidence that it was functional?
There was not, and I do not believe that that was required under the statute either.
And that's why we're here.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
That's why we're here.
Well, as Judge Fisher's questions pointed to the issue earlier, the statute would require that the weapon be readily capable of lethal use. It certainly says nothing about functionality. In these cases
couldn't you use a gun like a blackjack? Couldn't you hit someone over the head with it?
That's definitely...
Wouldn't that be lethal use? Does it have to be used for shooting someone versus hitting someone with it?
Well, that's definitely a possibility under the statute. However, considering that a firearm is used, that is the use that the weapon is designed for. It's designed and the purpose of it is for lethal use.
Well, so, opposing counsel says the statute says as part of the requirements for the crime that it has to be readily capable of lethal use, and therefore it's an element of the state's burden to show that it in fact is at the time it's being used readily capable. And that so that requires showing it's functioning or showing it's loaded. Why is that an incorrect interpretation of the statute?
Well, the readily capable is an element under the statute, and the MAI incorporates that. However, to show that it is loaded or functional, those are not requirements that have been set forth in the case law. The case law is very clear that it's not necessary to show that the weapon was loaded, and there's a number.
What does it mean by saying you have to show it's a weapon readily capable of lethal use? What does that mean you have to show? What is the prosecutor's burden?
Well, in these cases such as Luchin or Richardson, the courts have held that it was sufficient to show the way the weapon was used in making the threats. That allows an inference that it is readily capable of lethal use. There's not any point in using the weapon to threaten in that manner unless the weapon is capable of inflicting that type of lethal harm.
But you don't have to show a knife is relatively, you don't have to show a knife or a blackjack is relatively accessible for lethal use, only a firearm.
Well, under the other statute, which covers carrying concealed, it refers to firearm, I believe knife, blackjack, or other weapon readily capable. Under this particular paragraph that we're looking at, which is paragraph 4, it does not specify any particular type of weapon, but it does say weapon readily capable of lethal use. So there would be two questions there. Number one, is it a weapon? And then number two, is it readily capable of lethal use? In this particular case, the weapon is a firearm. So I think there would be a presumption from the fact that it is a firearm that it is also readily capable of lethal use. The defendant could certainly put on evidence that the gun wasn't working or it's encased in plastic or something like that.
Let's assume that the defendant did want to put on some evidence that the gun wasn't working. Does this statute, like the carrying concealed statute, have what's known as special negative defenses? Could the defendant have raised special negative defenses in this case?
Well, the other statute which covers carrying concealed, which is in paragraph 1 of the 571.030.1, there is a special defense there in subsection 3, which refers to a non-functioning weapon, and then there are other exceptions such as travel and so forth.
I'm not trying to confuse you, but this statute under which this defendant was confused or charged with, does it have a similar list of special negative defenses or not?
No, it does not, and that's what I was trying to get at. The statute does not contain that, but then certainly the defendant could negate an element by putting on the evidence. So he could negate the element without having a special negative defense.
Are you held to whatever statute you charge? I mean, you charge with this statute, but you want to use the other statute to say, well, there's other aspects to it that are more favorable to the prosecution.
Well, I was simply relying on the other paragraph as supporting authority because that is what the motion court did as well. And I think the motion court was quite progressive in making that interpretation because the cases have relied on the angry or threatening manner in which the weapon was used in order to show that circumstantial evidence and the inference that the weapon is readily capable of lethal use. So I am applying the paragraph 4, but I think that paragraph 1 certainly supports it as well. But then the real issue here is appellate counsel and his duty to raise the issue. And so it was well settled under the case law, even cases that go back into the 80s and 90s. So there was no duty on the part of a reasonably competent and effective lawyer to raise such an issue on appeal. There was no reasonable probability at all that a sufficiency challenge would have had any likelihood of success. So
you also argued that even if counsel had raised it, or even if there was a duty to raise it, that there's no reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. Can you expand upon that?
Well, right, and I think that it hits upon the same prong as well because there was no duty to raise it, partly because it wouldn't have been successful on appeal. Under the settled case law, there is sufficient evidence because of the manner in which the weapon was used, so it would not have been successful if raised on appeal. There were other issues that were raised on appeal. One was the voir dire in allowing the state to question the jurors if they would require recovery of a weapon in order to convict under this crime. But under the settled case law, there was no sufficiency challenge that could have been successful on these facts of the case because, for one thing, the appellant held the gun to DW's head. She was so frightened she slid down to the floor, and then he pointed it at the other victims as well. He did make a threat to kill her, although at a later time it was a threat to kill her. So there was abundant evidence in this case. There was also evidence as to generally the type of weapon. It was a pistol or a revolver. It was described as silver or chrome, and the witnesses did say it was a little or small gun, but nonetheless, there's abundant proof here that it was a gun, and with these threats, there's no other reasonable inference but that it's readily capable of lethal use. So,
what if they put on evidence that, in fact, it was non-functioning, had no firing pin, not just that it was unloaded, but that it couldn't be used to shoot, in fact? Would he still be liable under the statute?
Well, that would certainly make a different case. and it would have to be readily capable of lethal use. And the MAI does not instruct any further. It just says readily capable of lethal use, so it doesn't give the jury any guidance as to how to handle that type of situation. I mean, I would venture to guess that that would be insufficient, but certainly not the facts that we have here.
Could you address the other point that is raised by the defendant?
Certainly.
Particularly, what interested me was whether, in fact, there was any allegation that the attorney knew of the existence of the witness.
Well, the point as raised on appeal, and I believe in the motion, was simply a failure to call the witness. So there is not a claim on appeal as to failure to investigate and discover the witness.
And there's no allegation in the claim of error that the allegation was that he told his counsel that the witness at trial had a criminal background, but was there an allegation that he told his attorney this other person knew could present evidence of the criminal history?
Well, I believe there was that allegation, but the only evidence was that the witness knew of these things, and it would have been improper impeachment in the first place. But also, I think what is really key is that it would not have produced a viable defense for the appellant. And also, the three witnesses all testified to the same thing, so their testimony was somewhat cumulative in that respect. So even if you were able to impeach one witness and essentially knock him out, there's still two more witnesses who are all testifying to the same thing. So it would have had no...
Part of what they would have testified to was an arrest. Is that correct? And that's not permissible?
I believe that it's not established here because there's no exception that's established on the appellant's facts. And it wouldn't have produced a viable defense anyway. Plus, the presumption, of course, is that the defense counsel's trial strategy is correct. And then his choice as to which witnesses to call is virtually unchallengeable on appeal.
The question I had was, it seems to me you don't need to get into any of that because she isn't alleging failure to investigate, and she isn't alleging that he told his counsel of the existence of the witness.
Well,
of
right.
Mr. Basic's existence as a witness.
And so you don't need to get into...
into whether the claim's meritorious or not.
Well, the key issue, again, is whether the witness would have negated an element or produced a viable defense for the defendant. And the clear answer is no in this particular situation. If there are no further questions, the judgment of the motion court should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your judicious use of the time.
You're more than welcome to that. Thank you.
And the same is the case with you. You don't have to use all the time, but use all the time you need.
Oh, no, I just wanted to say I would like the court to take a look at Judge Draper's opinion. I think it is thorough, it is complete, and what he only asked for is for this court to reverse and remand for a hearing for Tim Fornaris to testify about his claim. And I think under these circumstances, that is warranted. Before we can go forward with this. If you have no more questions.
His views are taken with some note when his views and opinions are taken with some note when they appear before us.
Thank you.
Thank you for appearing.